Okay, good afternoon. Okay, so last time we talked about other things besides signatures that antivirus does, like looking for just mistakes made by malware, like messing up executables, and also just looking for bad behavior. So looking directly at, are you just changing files that we don't think any software should change? Things like that. And we talked about antivirus strategies, starting with ways of primarily evading signatures. And the big idea, and this is a big common theme, was to have quote unquote encrypted stuff. That you take part of your malware and you do something akin to encrypting it, except unlike if I wanted to encrypt something for real, you have the key right there, and you basically have some self-decrypting stuff. And the usual strategy that we saw, which wasn't as clear as I'd like to be, was that we had these changing encryptors in order to defeat signatures on the encryptor, and the other stuff was encrypted, so the virus malware authors assumed that that was safe from signatures. Today we're going to go beyond that. But before I move on, let's do some little logistics. So there's a homework assignment due Friday. Any questions on the homework assignment due Friday? So, good. And continuing our pattern, we have an assignment on, which I mentioned earlier, on writing a scanner for a simple pattern. And the pattern you're going to look for is this push of something, the machine code for this, not the literal string, because in an executable you're not going to find this string, most likely. But the machine code for push a value onto the stack and then return, which we assume has to be malware, because what compiler would generate this instead of a jump? And so you're going to need to use Flex. So here's a slide which you can look up when you do the assignment, if you need to remember how to do regular expressions. But this is the only pattern you need to match. It should be quite simple. And we give you some example Flex files like the ones we saw in lecture, so you can do the work of actually figuring out, printing out, not only did you find it, but where in the file is it, what bytes are it. So the first part of the assignment is to write this scanner. And for the second part, I give you an executable file, a real executable file from that's probably the same as one in your VM, but I give you a copy of it in case it's different. And so you can do this on pretty much any Linux system. That has a false positive that matches this pattern, but it's not because the code is actually doing this kind of push and ret. And there's a question to explain why that happened. What triggered the false positive, and propose some way you could fix that. And I ask you to propose it in enough detail that you could implement it from your proposal. So, you know, don't tell me something like, you know, if you think the pattern occurs because this is in non-code parts, don't tell me don't look in the non-code parts, because that is not specific enough to implement. You need to say how you're going to find out what's coding, what's not, and something like that, if you think that's what actually happened, which might not be the best answer. So any questions on the upcoming assignment? So this is out Friday, due a week from Friday, continuing our pattern. Okay. So today, we're going to look at going beyond what we saw before with changing encryptors to having a changing encryptor in body. And also talk about defeating things besides signatures. So when we have a changing encryptor in body, we've pretty much gotten rid of all the easy ways of making signatures work. Because every part of our malware is going to change. The malware code on disk is going to change everywhere, and the malware stuff in memory is going to change. And so at that point, we're going to be worried about other strategies, like behavior blocking, like trying to see, are you modifying files you're not supposed to? That's going to be the effective techniques after we quote-unquote, fix these problems. So first, I'd like to go back to our example of a polymorphic virus and try to explain why there's a big difference between having a changing body and encryptor and a changing encryptor. So this was our changing encryptor for this 1260 virus, where it had these dummy no-op things in the middle, and it also changed the order of some instructions a little bit, maybe. So we had these variants of the encryptor, and because of these no-ops that actually act on, which are real operations, but they just act on registers that we don't care about, this is actually very hard to detect with a signature. You could probably write one, but it's not going to be easy to match because there's all these wildcards, so there's lots of places where you'll see something that looks like a normal move in code, followed by another move, followed by an XOR, and you'll need to match all those cases, even when there's like other things in the middle of various sorts. So there's likely to be expensive to match, even if you write a good pattern for it. And it's a lot of effort to write a good pattern. It's not clear how you do that. You probably need to really understand what are all the things, variants that could be generated. Yeah?
Since they're all self-propagating, don't you really have like a kind of a template for what they're using? You could like reverse that into a...
Yeah, your arc is self-propagating, so you have the code which generates this. Couldn't you just turn that into a pattern? So my impression is that conceptually, that's the template, but it's not a regular expression. It's not something we can efficiently match. I can't give you a piece of code and say, find anything which is an output of this. That is not an easy thing to do. But we do have the template there, and conceptually there might be some relatively complicated program analysis technique which could automatically produce patterns in a lot of cases. I don't know if people have done work on that, and explaining how to do that would almost certainly be a topic for a graduate course. But bringing up the idea that we have a template explains why we have this form of just changing the encryptor is what we have. So probably what they're doing, they don't have to do it this way, but this is the easiest way of changing your encryptor, is that you have something that generates a decryptor. And you generate a random key, you have some write random not function that you call, you get a random number and decide whether you reorder things, and so on. So there's likely some function like this for generating the decryptor. Which meant that, unlike I kind of hinted at earlier, you might need to do, that we're not doing something like copying code and inserting nops. We just have a template, so we don't need to worry about doing any parsing of code whatsoever, or really knowing pretty much anything about how the machine code works. Yes, we have to know how to write machine code, but that's basically something you could do. The author of this malware could have just assembled something and looked at object dump to write those functions pretty easily. They didn't have to do any real understanding of how machine code works. But the techniques where we're going to end up changing our body are going to be ones where we probably can't get away with that. Yes, we could technically write something where we have a template like this, which it somehow generates itself. I showed you an example of that with sort of printf and %s earlier, but that's pretty convoluted to do. So most likely, the easiest thing to do is going to be to do something where we actually need to read machine code, where we need to take this stuff when it's decrypted and process it to generate a new version, rather than having some template we can fill in. Just because we don't have a way of including this function that fills in the template in our template without going through a lot of work. It's not that it's impossible, it's just that it's likely more work than actually parsing machine code. Even though parsing machine code is really annoying. So the techniques we've seen before this are just ones where we have sort of a template of what the decryptors are in the encrypted part. And that template doesn't change. All that stuff doesn't change. And so it's easy to change what the template is. It's easy to make changes to the other parts of the malware, not worry about anything breaking. And you can even do really simple things. Like if you want multiple decryptors in the encrypted stuff, you could just have multiple copies of the decryptor with changes. You don't even need something as complicated as this. And that was something that some early oligomorphic viruses did. Is they had an encrypted part with just multiple versions of the encryptor, like six of them, and they chose one at random. It's better to have something like this, because there's a lot more variance that way, but you don't need to do anything very sophisticated. And so this means that the technique we talked about for actually finding these with signatures is very nice for antivirus software, because the next step up where we actually end up needing to read machine code is actually a big jump in effort for the malware author. But doing these changing decryptors is actually pretty simple just because you have this encrypted part where you can put all the code to do that. So you don't need to do it in any particularly clever way. And we have this common theme here of detection techniques where we go beyond simple signatures on what's stored in the file, where we just run something and see what happens. So we did this for behavior-based detection. We run it and see, is it trying to modify something it shouldn't? We do it for defeating encryptors. We run the decryptor and then see what it generates. See if it matches some pattern we don't like. And this is a very nice technique because it's very effective and it requires a lot more effort for the malware author to get around. Or at least so it seems. We might disagree with that after this lecture. But it's much slower than pattern matching. And there's going to be some other countermeasures we'll talk about with that. So before, yeah. We'll probably get to that. The question is it possible to make it seem like a different file is changing or something like that? We'll get to things like that in a bit. So I mentioned behavior-based detection, and I'd like to mention a few sort of missing holes in that and also talk about what these countermeasures are before we get back to actually doing metamorphic, the case where we change bodies. I'll get back to that later, but first we'll talk about the things that polymorphic viruses would do before they bother going through all the effort of parsing their machine code to have a body which isn't a signature when it's decrypted. And also to defeat the simple behavior-based detection that antivirus software might want to do. So with behavior-based detection, sort of one thing I mentioned here is detecting modifications in things like executables. And there's one special version of that which comes up a lot that malware makes a particular effort to do. And that's that when people are analyzing malware, or maybe perhaps when antivirus software wants to detect malware, you set up what Zor calls a sacrificial goat, basically, a goat file, which is something you want to get infected by some self-propagating malware. And the idea is that if this file exists only to get infected, if anything changes it, well, that's probably malware. Also, this is very valuable for analysis. If you have something which inserts itself in cavities in an executable file, it's much easier to see how it's doing that if you give it an executable file with like a nice big cavity so it puts all its code in one place. So that's a reason to do this. It also is a way to get multiple versions of something which self-propagates. So when you have things which changing decryptors and you want samples of 100 versions of the decryptor, well, you make 100 files for it to infect. And you get 100 copies of it, and that gives you an idea how to write a pattern that matches that decryptor if there's one you can write. And malware authors are, at least seem to be aware that this is a thing that's done. Even though it seems primarily for analysis, even though it's an antivirus technique, but it seems primarily used for analysis. So they'll often do things where they're picky about what executables they infect. Or they use heuristics to avoid files which look strange, just like antivirus software use heuristics to say, you made an executable look strange, malware. The malware says, oh, this is a strange executable. I don't want to deal with that. So they'll like look for very small programs and say, let's not infect that. It's probably a decoy. Or very, very big programs. Let's not infect that. It's probably something where they just wanted to make sure they got all my code in one place. Things like that. Okay. So that's our diversion into sort of the simple behavioral detection. And this is sort of part of the whole set of strategies, which are try it and see. And we had the biggest try it and see strategy was for finding these packers. That to get the self-decrypting code to run, we just run it. And we want to run it in a VM or an emulator. We don't want to actually not have control over how it's going to work. We want to stop it in sometime in the middle and scan its memory. And also, we want a virtual machine for other reasons, because this is also a good way to detect if it's doing something strange, like accessing files it shouldn't. The virtual same mechanism that lets us run it in a virtual machine lets us easily see what changes it makes to the system. So for all these techniques, having a virtual machine is very valuable for both analysis and for the antivirus software itself. And as I mentioned, it defeats the entire strategy. So one thing this means is that we want to actually do anti-virtualization if we're a malware author. So we want to do things that will detect if we're in a virtual machine, and we want to not do the thing that will be detected as dangerous in that case. And I mentioned when we talked about VMs, several techniques for trying to see if you're in a VM. So one of them was we can query the devices. That unless VMs are designed to be stealthy, they generally aren't. Like, if you run in VirtualBox, there's a device driver named like VirtualBox. Pretty big sign that you're in a VM. So that's a big sign. That's a very useful thing. So the solution to that, if you're making a VM for antivirus software, you need to make sure all of those mirror some real machine, which is extra effort you ordinarily don't care about when you're making a VM. So another thing we mentioned is that some things are going to be slower in the VM. And this is a particularly bad problem for the sort of VMs that antivirus software is going to use, because they want to look for other things besides just running the code correctly. They want to observe its behavior, and that likely means that they're going to be tempted to use one of the slower implementation techniques we talked about, like binary translation or emulation. So the technique here is you just do something which is slower, see that it's slower than it would ever be on a real machine, or at least be confident enough. If you're a malware, you don't need to be 100% right, which is great. You know, something like system calls or allocating memory, you just hope that that doesn't work as fast in the VM because extra work is done to do that. That wouldn't be done on the real machine. So there's a solution to this. What can we do to keep malware from using this strategy? Yeah?
You write your own kind of clock. So like you use your own clock methods, I guess.
So the most general way of dealing with this is that the only way the malware can learn what time it is if you tell it in your VM. So if you implement your virtual machine, So when something in the virtual machine asks what time it is, it says uses a virtual clock that knows how long a system call or allocating memory is supposed to take, then this is going to be very hard to detect. So conceptually, that's a way you can deal with it. It's just have a virtual clock, and there should be no way of detecting it. Now, implementing that virtual clock correctly seems very hard. There's lots of operations where you're doing something which take variable amounts of time in a real machine. If you've done any performance programming, you know that knowing how long things take on a computer, on a modern computer with a cache, is very difficult. But you can hope that you can do it well enough that simple techniques of timing things are not going to reveal anything strange. Another thing I noticed that if you're using native virtual machine stuff, I tried to make up an example where I could detect what operations were slow. And it's actually very hard when you have native support, when you have hardware support for the virtual machine. It's likely not going to be hard when we don't have hardware support, when we're using something like binary translation. But when you have hardware support, most things actually are almost the same speed. You need to be very careful to figure out something which is a different speed. So the other option here is using operations that aren't supported by the VM. And this is probably both the easiest technique for malware to use and one of the most annoying to fix. And it's more annoying for antivirus software than it is for fixing it for, say, VirtualBox. So there's various sorts of things that won't be implemented. And the most obvious would be, let's say you don't implement some instructions. So you don't implement the latest vector instructions. You don't implement floating point in your VM. Well, that's easy to detect, and that's a big giveaway, right? All real chips that anyone's likely using that you care about, you have floating point. Your VM doesn't, means it's not a real thing, system, as far as we're concerned today. And there's other tricks like that. So some malware actually used undocumented CPU instructions. There was a time when Intel forgot to document a few instructions. And antivirus software had emulators which said, oh, this is undocumented. This is documented as no-op. It's a no-op, right? No-op you shouldn't use. And it wasn't a no-op, and they detected that. But a bigger issue is operating system stuff. And the reason this is an issue is that if you're an antivirus software, what are you running in a VM? You're running an executable that you think might be malicious. You're not running an entire system. So you're not making a system virtual machine, the sort that VirtualBox is. You're making a process virtual machine. You're doing what the OS would do, which means you need to somehow implement some facsimile of all the OS services. Like, if the software you're running asks to open a network connection, you need to give a response to that. So you need to like say, oh, sorry, we're not connected. But you need to implement that as the antivirus virtual machine implementer. And even though x86 has a lot of instructions, it's actually a lot less straightforward to handle all these sorts of OS features. And some examples from Zor of features that commonly weren't handled by early antivirus virtual machines are things like setting up a handler for segfaults. So in many operating systems, you can say, if my program segfaults, I'd like you to try to run this function so I can fix it. Many antivirus emulators often just crashed instead, just said the program crashed and we're done. In that case, rather than handling this operating system feature. Now there was multi-threading. Yeah?
So is the reason that they wouldn't use a full system VM just for lower overhead?
So the question is, why didn't they use a full system VM? Is it just for lower overhead? So one reason is, yes, that it's lower overhead. But they also want to know about the system-y stuff that the virus is doing, and that it's much easier to do. Sorry, like they want to know if the virus is changing files, and that it's much easier to do with a process VM than a system VM. So if you wanted to know if the virus was changing files, with a system VM, what you'd have to do is you'd have to have like your dummy copy of Windows that you load from scratch. Then you start, copy the malware program that you're analyzing into that, run it into up to some point, then stop it. Then you need to somehow shut down that copy of Windows well enough that you know the files will be in the file system there, and then read them. That's actually pretty difficult. Especially, you need to somehow shut it down when you've gotten far enough that you went to look at what's happened. So you can actually read the files of the file system. So everything's saved on disk. It's actually going to be easier to do that if you do the process VM strategy, where instead you implement the write file command yourself. So you have a hook on that where you say, oh, it's writing a file. That's a much easier way to discover that this in my virtual environment, it tried to modify a file. So there's big incentives for the antivirus makers, besides performance, to not use a system VM, because it lets them get better visibility into what the program is doing. Now, conceptually, you could like look into the memory of like Windows that's running in the system VM and figure out what files changed, but that's actually very difficult, right? You need to understand a lot about how Windows works to do that. And I have, yeah. So any other questions on these sorts of unsupported things and why we're using a process VM for this? Or why we probably would use a process VM? Okay, so those were the techniques we talked about when I talked about virtual machines initially. Now there's some other ones which work mostly because of how antivirus software is going to use virtual machines. One surprisingly simple one is just about patience, basically. If antivirus software is going to detect if some file is malicious by trying to run it in a VM and see if it has like some code which matches a signature, it's not going to wait forever. It's going to stop eventually. So the question is, how does it know when to stop? It has to make some choice. And some malware had the solution of just, let's take a long time before we generate our decrypted code. Let's just need to run for like 10 minutes before that happens. And it's not even 10 minutes, because if you're using one of the slower virtualization techniques, then a second of emulation might be like a millisecond on a normal machine, in which case you don't even need to take a user perceptible amount of time to be too slow for the VM. So this is a real and common strategy, and this is really annoying for this technique, because there's nothing really stopping the antivirus software from taking however long it wants to do this. To actually generate its infecting code, it can wait. When a user runs Word, they're going to have it open for an hour. So if you've infected Word, you have an hour, and you're not going to probably miss very much by spending an hour before you actually run your virus code. But the malware, the antivirus software, which is running you in a VM to look for a signature, either needs to scan over that hour, or it needs to give up at some point. And giving up is the reason that they have problems. And there's another form of this, which is particularly clever and elegant, which is, rather than taking a while, which maybe the antivirus software could get smart and say, and wait and run for long enough to withstand that patience, is to just not infect consistently. So instead of writing your normal virus code, you have to do something like this. You generate a random number, if it's say 4, you actually infect your malicious stuff. Otherwise, you don't. So most of the time, when the antivirus emulates your code and figures out what it does, it says, oh, it's clean. Didn't do anything malicious. There's this weird branch that there's this if statement you didn't use, but that's normal. Lots of programs have stuff you don't run all the time. And in most real executions, you're not going to do anything. eventually, when the user runs this program, you'll actually infect it. Yeah. Yeah, so it's random, so the question is, what if it accidentally infects the time the antivirus emulator runs? And that's a risk of this technique, so it's not perfect, but by adjusting, you can sort of adjust that trade-off by how often you let your, what you require the random number to be. So you can make it detect you 1% of the time in exchange for infecting 1 out of 100 runs. Which, for some program which is run all the time, is probably a pretty good trade-off. So any questions on these sort of anti-emulation techniques? Now we'll move on to dealing with the other side of this problem, which is, let's say we can't get our anti-virtualization stuff to work consistently. And we're worried about the antivirus software managing to run us, and despite us looking for that funny device file to see if we're really in an emulator, we still end up decrypting our code, and now the antivirus software has a signature it can check. So we're going to talk about getting rid of this GWT signature here, making it so, even though our decryptor changes, making it so this decrypted code also changes. So if the antivirus software runs us long enough to get this decrypted code, it doesn't have a GWT signature anymore. Yeah. Unless someone went through the effort of figuring out what the pattern was, including all these various holes where there might be one operation versus another or a knob and things like that, that they're not going to actually be able to scan our memory and find this. And this is called metamorphic. So we talked about oligomorphic and polymorphic. Those are things which change the decryptor only. So then we have metamorphic, which change everything, including the decrypted body. They pretty much universally still use this pattern of having a decryptor followed by the rest of the code, but the rest of the code also changes. I don't think they need to do that, but I guess they felt it was easier, and it evolved from polymorphic malware. And as I said earlier, this is a big change in difficulty. So in a polymorphic code, you have, you know, you would have this template with blanks in some form. We had one form I showed you earlier where, like, we had a function which we said print no op, print move, etc. That's effectively a template with blanks to fill in. Whereas here, the easiest strategy is going to be to actually parse machine code enough to change it. So the main difficulty here is that all this malware we're talking about generally was targeting x86. And x86 machine code is pretty annoying. But conceptually, the sorts of changes you might make, some of them are pretty simple. So for example, some malware does this change. So if you look carefully, you can figure out what happened between these two snippets. So can anyone explain what the change was?
Yeah. Registers.
Yeah, so they just swapped all the registers around. They just changed every single register specified anywhere. It's a very mechanical thing to do if you have an instruction parser. You just make a table with a random assignment from old register name to new register name, and you find all the register number pieces in the instruction and change them. And this is pretty annoying for signatures because, yeah, you can write a signature for this, but it's going to have a lot of conditional things where you expect, you know, the byte with ESI or EDI, and you need lots of alternatives. So it still has good signatures, and this is often going to be true of these techniques, that you're going to do some transformation like this, which isn't going to get rid of signatures, but it's going to make them pretty annoying. And it's also not going to be obvious how you automatically come up with these signatures. Right? There's basically no useful constant string when you do this transformation, because we've changed some bits of every instruction. Yeah. So, yeah, so the question is, so if this antivirus just ignored the registers and just looked at the rest of the opcodes, wouldn't that detect this? Yes, so we could write a scanner like that, which has an x86 parser, and looks for just the opcodes. And that might be something you do. But we're going to talk about other transformations, which are also fairly simple, which will easily mess that up. But it is true for generally for any of these techniques, we could come up with sort of simple, like sort of one-off solutions like that, which will give us a signature. And it seems to be generally the case that usually these metamorphic viruses, it's not the case that there's no signature, but it's the case that the signature is pretty annoying to write down and efficiently match. And that's true of this sort of register swap. Like, it's easy to explain, and it's not that hard to implement, but it's pretty annoying to actually make a scanner for that's both reliable and fast. And remember that this is being done in addition to needing to run the VM first to get the stuff to match. So you're already spending a lot of overhead, and now you want to run an expensive scanner speculatively, assuming you ran that VM for long enough. So let's look at an example of a particular metamorphic virus from this article, which I link off the schedule page. And this article talks about the interesting part of the virus, which is what's known as its mutation engine, which is the name that seems to be used for something where we take some code and end up with other code. And a lot of these have been written. And the usual pattern is that there's three big steps. So first, we need something which effectively disassembles the code. And the big thing we need to get out of that is instruction lines. We need to separate it out into specific instructions. And then we pass each of those instructions to something which does a transformation. So the transformation we saw earlier was just changing register numbers. It looked at the instruction, figured out where the register numbers were, and changed them. In this case, we'll be talking about more general transformations, including transformations which change how big instructions are in memory, change the size of instruction in machine code. And it's certainly a lot more deceptive for making it hard to write signatures if the size of the code changes. And this Evol virus did that. But if you do that, that means that you might have like a loop with jumps, let's say, which means that you need to fix that loop so it still works. So there's this extra relocation step where we take any jumps which have a label target, conceptually, which is represented as an offset typically or an address in the machine code, and we need to make sure our new machine code has the correct target even though this transformation changed the length of the instruction from the original. And this seems conceptually simple, but pretty annoying. Because first of all, our first step here is that we're going to find the lengths of all our instructions, which, given what I told you about how x86 encoding works, seems really annoying. You know, we have instruction prefixes, we need to parse the MARDRM bytes, you need this big table of what all the opcodes are, because you need to look at the opcode to know how many things there are after it with operands. And there's this trick which pretty much all these mutation engines use, which is that they just don't handle everything. So for a vol, it only handles 61 opcodes. And 32 of them are sort of opcodes which all start with the same 4 bits and basically act the same, like all conditional jumps that start with 7 in the top 4 bits of the opcode. So those all act the same. So basically, if you subtract the 32, they're dealing with like less than 30 real things. That's not actually that bad. They also don't handle some features of x86. They just say, well, I'm not going to write a code which does this. So they don't handle instruction prefixes. They just don't write assembly code which needs instruction prefixes. They don't handle any floating point instructions whatsoever. They just don't use it. And they don't handle all the addressing modes. So you know that x86 lets you use index, scale, offset. They only use register, constant, or offset and register. All the other, the addressing modes, which take 2 registers to specify a memory location, they just don't implement those. They just don't know how to find the length of those instructions or do anything with them. So after you've split up things into instructions, there's a transformation step. And this part is conceptually easier than the disassembly step because a correct thing to do is easy. So what's a correct thing I can do in the transformation step that is the simplest to implement? So you said change the registers, something even simpler than changing the registers. If I don't know how to handle something, what can I do? What? Sorry? You can just leave it. So if we don't have a way to handle an instruction we see, as long as we know it's a whole instruction, we can just not do anything to it. And it's still valuable to be doing this transformation step as long as we handle enough of our instructions. But to get a minimal transformation step, you just do nothing. And of all, did sort of a combination of these. So some stuff, they just didn't have another version of. They just didn't generate anything. They didn't even change register numbers. For some stuff, they had a table which said something like, when you get an instruction like this, you turn it into this. Possibly even with that hard-coded offset. And that's fine that they don't handle all offsets because their default thing is just going to be to leave it alone. It's still going to be correct. And they had a table of these, and sometimes they had multiple alternatives, sometimes they just had one. And that's what they did. The transformation step just did a table lookup. If it found it, it chose an entry from the table as output, which is equivalent. Otherwise, it just generated the same thing. Yes?
So all this table and stuff, like the virus writer just had to like think of a bunch of things that equal each other?
Yes. So the question is, this table, how was it made? Yeah, and the virus writer just thought of a bunch of things that are equivalent. So like they said, you could do this move. Oh, we can do this with a different move, with a different register. That's what they did here. So they said, okay, this is moving into EBP. We're going to change that to use an offset from EAX by doing an addition. We're going to use push and pop to save it so we can put this anywhere and it will still work. And they just came up with this alternative for this assembly by hand. Now, conceptually, you could do it automatically, but this does not seem to be a level of sophistication that many people who write mutation engines have. It probably was not possible until pretty recently, because if you wanted to do this automatically, you need to have something which can say, look at this sequence of instructions and say, what does it do? Which that sort of software exists, but it's pretty modern stuff, like Incompilers has it. It's not generally available. Yeah?
So earlier, last lecture, we were going to
Yeah.
This one will, won't it?
So this one looks like, well, we're getting pretty, it looks like it's making it pretty big. So yeah, this might be a giveaway where it changes the file size, where we're probably not going to be able to fit in little holes if we're doing this sort of transformation. So it's better not to change the file size. It doesn't mean that you can get away with it all the time. And you'll note that this transformation, this is pretty lazily written. It's not like they're doing clever things to produce obviously good, or even kind of good-looking code. Like, if you look at this disassembly by hand, you can tell something weird is going on. You might not figure out what it's doing, but you can tell, why are we pushing and popping when we probably have plenty of registers around, not saving things to the stack? Seems pretty weird. And these transformations make the code keep getting bigger and bigger each time it propagates. Just happened to be what happened. It doesn't have to work that way, but that's a common thing because the easiest equivalent things to write are going to be larger than your original because presumably you started off with the simplest thing. And as I mentioned, a problem with having this bigger version is that we're going to break things like jumps unless we do some effort to fix them. So we need to somehow deal with things which reference addresses in our code, which most notably would be jumps, like for a loop, and fix those. So we need to do relocation. We basically need to do the linker's work again. So let's say we have this piece of code, which is maybe what a decryptor would look like. And I have, instead of using a label, I've used an address that's an offset from, say, the beginning of the code. So a way you can implement relocation is by keeping track of the mapping between this original code here and whatever you generate from your table. So you want to know where this 0x9 instruction, this XOR, whatever you transform that into, you want to know where that ends up. So as you're doing your transformation and you do your table lookup, you can make this table where you say the thing that was originally 9 bytes from the beginning is now 20. And then you need this extra step where your transformation needs to know where are addresses in the thing I transformed that I might need to change. So unlike the case where we could just get away with not changing anything, not knowing anything about the instruction, in this case, we need to know about this jump. We need to know that it is a jump with a relative address, and we need to write down, okay, this goes to address 9, which actually means that there's the number of bytes from here to here is what's in the instruction. So we need to understand the machine code well enough to decode that. But we can just write that in this table. So in this table we say, okay, there was something at address 14, which is now at address 29, and it was referring to when the instruction that was originally at address 9. And after we produce this table, we can go through a second pass and look at everything where there's some address that was being referred to. So in this case, we only have one thing. For everything where there wasn't, we don't need to change anything. But for the things where there was, we need to say, okay, so in our new code, we have an address which is somewhere in this instruction, let's say 1 byte afterwards, which previously referred to 9, address 9, and now it needs to refer to 20. So we just need to know what the format of that is in the machine code and copy the new value in. And we looked up this new value by just scanning for this 9 in this table. So does this process make sense to people? So this is how we can deal with jumps, which are basically the really tricky part here. It's dealing with places where we change some addresses around. And we can also notably make this easier on ourselves by restricting what instructions we handle. So for example, in the Evol virus, they only handled relative jumps. They didn't use calls. They didn't use any other kind of control transfer instruction. They didn't read data from an offset somewhere. So they didn't need to deal with any other sort of changing addresses in the code. And that made this simpler than doing this for general sort of x86 programs, which you could do probably, but not really worth it. So that was our tour of these steps for a relocation engine. And so Evol did this in a particular way, but the steps are basically the same no matter who's doing it. You might just have a different level of sophistication in each of these operations. And in particular, different choices about what transformations to do, which is the biggest thing which affects how you detect this from the result. Because the transformations we did don't mean there's no pattern, because, well, this is pretty distinctive, actually. But it's much more annoying to write a reliable pattern to match it. Yeah? So the question is, if this table was in the antivirus code, couldn't they use it to predict it? So I described it as a table. And that might not be what it actually is. Most likely the form this would take, given the restriction for Evol in particular, given the restrictions in how what it can transform, is that it's actually a bunch of like if statements. So it's conceptually a table, but it's actually implemented as if instruction equals this, then generate this code, and so on. So it still gets so when it's represented as if statements like that, it still gets transformed by the same rules, in fact. So it can't. So there's not like a representation of this instruction as a constant. It's instead, constructed by doing moving a 1 byte value from somewhere and things like that. Like if the first byte equals that the first byte of this and the second byte. So that's the sort of code that might actually appear. And you can transform that code with these rules, so it's annoying to detect still, even though we conceptually have a table. Other questions? So I showed you sort of one example of a mutation engine, and there's whole families of these. And apparently what Soar says is done typically is that they try to build a detector for a particular mutation engine. So they just go through what the transformation rules are, figure out how we can actually make a signature to match that, usually manually. Apparently, maybe it's automatable, but I don't know of anyone doing that. So it's very tedious. So it works for a while, until someone goes through that tedious manual work of writing a detector. And usually you can probably write something like a regular expression that will match the transform code. Just because it's not like they're, especially with the transformations we saw, they aren't doing anything super clever. And it makes sense because this is the easiest thing to do. That still transforms all the stuff in memory. And generally what seems to happen is that someone will write a mutation engine, a whole bunch of malware will use it until it starts working, and then they'll switch on to the next one. Okay. So we covered sort of the sort of bedrock anti-antivirus techniques, which were about dealing with the signature-based stuff. In particular, not only defeating signatures directly, but also defeating techniques which try to deal with the first line defense to signatures, which is having these packers, having encrypted code. Either by breaking VMs and emulators or by making it so there's not a good signature even after you run the decryptor. So we're going to also look at some other things that malware does. And one of them is breaking debuggers. So there are two reasons we might want to break debuggers. So one is that it makes analysis a lot more annoying. The debugger doesn't work. This might be one way you'd actually like manually figure out what a virus is doing, and say for your mutation engine, figure out how to write that complex pattern which matches it, which apparently is done by hand. It also might be the case that the mechanisms that debuggers use would be used by some implementations of virtual machines. So let's talk a bit about how debuggers work. And I'm going to talk about two features of debuggers that are particularly attacked. So one is breakpoints. So breakpoints mean that the debugger gets control when you reach a certain instruction. They're probably the most commonly used feature in debuggers. So can anyone give me an idea of how you'd implement breakpoints? I assert that you almost know enough to do this. Or you one little minor difficulty, but you almost know enough about how code executes to figure out how to do this. But it is a bit of a trick. Okay. Okay, so the idea is we know what the program counter should be, and when it reaches that, we stop. So the problem is that we're not running if that's happening, right? Unless we're emulating the program, when the program counter reaches that, the processor wants to run the instruction that's there, not us, not the debugger. Yeah?
We kind of insert jumps to the debugger's code.
Yeah, so the idea is insert jumps to the debugger's code. So the trick is that you usually don't think of modifying some machine code, but the simplest way of implementing a debugger, the breakpoint feature, is that you just take where your breakpoint is and you replace it with a jump to the debugging code in the machine code. So you have something which parses machine code well enough to do this, and insert that. So is there any problem with this idea? Yeah?
You can mess up the spacing between other jumps.
So you're worried that, it could mess up the spacing between other jumps, that this new jump instruction might not be the same size as this add. Yeah? So the question is, where did the add go? That's a good question. So somehow, we want to eventually run this add. So the most likely thing is that when we leave the breakpoint, we change back to this version of the code, and then jump to the add. And if you want to keep the breakpoint there, we need to do this little bit of a dance, where we set a breakpoint at the next instruction, then run this one, and then go back. And then when we hit the breakpoint at the next instruction, redo setting of this breakpoint up here, this jump up here. Yeah?
The virus can check if it's jumping somewhere that it's not expected to not jump, take out the jump.
So you're skipping ahead. You're saying, well, the virus can just check if it's jumping somewhere it's not expecting to. That's an interesting assertion. So how would the virus check this?
Well, I mean, presumably whoever wrote the virus knows all the jumps that they would make, and they could see if the jump is going outside of the memory that they're committing to jump.
Okay, so they're going to know where all the jumps are, and they're going to look at all the jumps. So we'll get to that later. But first, I'll mention the other problem we talked about, which one of this add isn't the right size to replace with a jump. No. It might be bigger, and this would be a problem. So it turns out that x86 has a feature designed to let debuggers do this. Designed to let debuggers say, I want to stop the next time you get to this instruction. They have this feature where they have a one byte instruction that's meant for debugger breakpoints. And its name is int3. And the one byte encoding is hex CC. So the way debuggers would traditionally implement breakpoints is they'd modify the machine code to insert that breakpoint by just editing the first byte of whatever the instruction is to CC. And when they want to continue from that breakpoint, they need to unmodify the code and jump back to it. If they want to keep the breakpoint there, they need to do something where they somehow get control after that at the next instruction and then update the code again. So this int3 actually is basically like a system call. So it invokes some handler that the OS decided to set up. But on most OSs, there's a way you can say, hi, I'm a debugger, give me access when this program runs this int3 instruction. Just call me from your handler. On older systems, the debugger might have actually changed the pointer in the processor data structure that handles this directly. But conceptually, just ask the OS, say, I want to handle this. So someone alluded to this strategy that, well, as a malware author, I know where all the jumps in my code are. I know that I don't have any debugging breakpoint instructions. So it's even easier than looking at all my jumps. I just need to say, I never use the opcode CC. It should not appear in my code. And we can do better than that, and simpler than that. So one thing we could do is we could just scan our machine code for int3. But an even better solution is that we scan our code. So we say load the size of our code and load a value in a register and load where our code is, and just iterate through our code and say add up the value of every 8 bytes with overflow. So it wraps around and get a checksum. This is the simplest version of a checksum. You just add up every number with wraparound and see what the sum is. And you record what the value you expect that to have is, which you compute when you generate your code. And if it doesn't match, hey, someone changed my machine code. And this detects any change. And this deals with things like, let's say I have CC in an offset. Doesn't matter. I'm going to check whether it changed from what I expected. Yeah. So the question is, so I said that the debugger might need to change the breakpoint back to run that instruction. So the question is, will this read the instruction when it's changed to a breakpoint? So the trick is that this transformation is going to happen whenever the breakpoint is still active. So as long as the debugger has that breakpoint set and wants it to trigger in the future, it's going to have this change made. So as long as this loop runs, when we've set a breakpoint, somewhere between my code and encode, we should be fine. We should actually detect that. The only possible case where something weird might happen is if the breakpoint is right here. That's where the debugger might be playing games with unsetting the breakpoint to just run this add instruction and then setting it again. Other questions about this sort of checksumming strategy? Yeah.
Won't this not work with polymorphic viruses and other viruses that change their size?
Okay, so doesn't this not work with sort of polymorphic viruses or other viruses which change their size? So we needed to do some setup that knows about our size here. So we needed to have this figure out how to get this offset to encode encoded in our compare instruction. So we could do that by just having some logic in our relocation step that handles that. So this is the same thing as making this jump work after our transformation. It's just a different way that the value is encoded. So the other part thing we need to fix is that we need this expected value. We need to actually know what that's supposed to be. So if a metamorphic or polymorphic virus is using this technique, it's going to need to somehow compute the expected value after it generates a new version of itself. But that's fairly simple. You just iterate through the code and fill in a blank where you know the value is, which you recorded the same way. You have some place, a table which says, hey, this is where I need to put the checksum value. Yes? So the question is, if I wanted to make a sneakier debugger, couldn't I set the breakpoint and modify the next thing to break this checksum? So the first thing to note is you said the next byte. This checksum is reading 8 bytes at a time. So you need to modify 8 bytes ahead. And that sort of thing is actually a big problem, because what's 8 bytes ahead of this add? You're going to, if you put the opposite of that, you're probably going to break some code you would want to work. The issue is that you don't know what jumps to say this sub. There could be a jump. So as a debugger, you know I need to insert a breakpoint here. You don't know, for example, how does code jump to this instruction? There could be other code which runs the instruction right after this add. So you don't know that code is going to reach your breakpoint before it reaches the following instruction. You could figure that out, but that requires a lot of analysis of the machine code, right? You need to like look at all the things that might be jumps. And it's not even clear you can do that reliably without, you know, some other tricks, like setting other breakpoints just in case something happens. So it's probably not a viable technique for debuggers to directly attack the sort of checksumming strategy. The other part of it is that it's very easy for the author of the malware to replace this add with, say, XOR, or some other accumulating operation. And it's not clear that there's a good generic way that a debugger could defeat this sort of strategy that way. Because it's just because this is so easy to change and still have it the same idea work. So this is one thing malware will do. We'll do this integrity check before it does anything bad. Now, the easiest solution as a manual analyst, not automatically, to this is actually to edit the code and insert a jump here to here. That's what you're going to do as an analyst. Probably. Or you'll just replace this jump here with a no-op. That's the easiest solution to this sort of debugger detection. So it's mostly an annoyance. But it is a real one. Yeah. Yes, you have to figure out it's there, but you probably will. So this is one way of detecting if there's a debugger active. There are some other ones which are easier to implement. So one thing is that you can just say, hey, I'd like to set up a debugger. And then you might find out, oh, there's already a debugger there from the OS. And that's a good hint. for example, Windows has this function, isDebuggerPresent. That is a real Windows API function. So these are other ways you can look for a debugger. They're less attractive, actually, because they're easier things for a stealthy debugger to fix. A stealthy debugger is going to have a harder time changing how it does breakpoints than it is going to just to replace the isDebuggerPresent function. Okay. So I told you about int 3. So this replacing breakpoints with something else. This is not actually the only mechanism on x86. So there is one which isn't susceptible to this technique. Yeah, you have a question?
I was going to say, if you're running it in a virtual machine process, can you change your opcode for a jump for the breakpoint to something else?
Okay, so someone said, if I'm running in a virtual machine, why do I need to, couldn't I not need to use this CC encoding, for example? And you can do, so if you're running in the sort of virtual machine where you're like doing binary translation or emulation, yeah, you can change what opcodes mean. You can do better than that. If you're running in that sort of virtual machine, you can just look at the PC after every instruction runs. You can actually implement this in a completely stealthy way. And there are debuggers which use this sort of implementation technique, where the debugger is actually a full emulator to avoid this sort of problem. But it's much slower and also pretty annoying to implement as a debugger often. So it's replacing breakpoints with CC, that's one thing. So we have this other strategy, which is have a virtual machine which is implemented in a slow way, and then you can do extra stuff on every instruction, like check if it matches something. And it turns out that modern x86 processors have a special feature for breakpoints, that on x86 there are 4 special registers which are used as breakpoints. So if you only need 4 breakpoints and you implement a debugger, you can set one of these registers, and if the program counter becomes equal to that address, it's going to do the same, basically the same thing it would do if you executed this int 3, this opcode CC instruction. But you don't have to modify the machine code. And in fact, this can be implemented in a way where if the debugger program tries to modify those registers, you as the debugger find out and emulate it. Or pretend it doesn't work or something like that. And this is makes sense that they'd implement it, because it's actually pretty cheap to implement in CPU. It's basically 4 registers and 4 comparators, just relatively inexpensive. But it's probably still the case that modern debuggers still modify the machine code, even though this mechanism exists. And the reason why is because if you need more than 4 breakpoints, you can't do this. Yeah?
Could you simply just make it, if more than 4, do it any other way?
So it's probably the case that's what they do. The question is, couldn't we, if there's less than 4, use this technique, otherwise use the other technique? And that's probably what they do. But it means that they still implement that other technique, and it's still not unlikely that you detect someone trying to debug your program by looking for changes in the machine code at runtime. So there's probably more other things you could do to hide the changes, which I'm not going to talk about, but mentioning the techniques. Okay, so the other piece of, well, I guess we're out of time, aren't we? So next time we will pick up with anti-debugging and talk a bit about retroviruses, and then hopefully move on to exploits.